I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is a heads up. About two-thirds of the way through this episode, the audio changes and is a bit harder to hear. We apologize in advance. Welcome to Tea and Murder, an Agatha Christie podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Tendy Norman. We are part book club, part interview show, all Agatha Christie. And I am here today with Ragnar Jonasson, who is an award-winning and international best-selling Icelandic author of crime fiction. His books have been sold in over 4 million copies in 35 countries, and his book The Darkness will start filming as a TV series later this year. Before writing crime novels, Ragnar translated 14 Agatha Christie books into Icelandic, starting at the age of 17. Welcome, Ragnar.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy you're here. So tell me a little bit about your relationship to Agatha Christie's work. When did you start reading her?
So I started reading Agatha Christie probably around the age of 12. Mm-hmm. I was introduced to her work by my cousin who had already read a few books, and he read, I think, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd, and mm-hmm. he was so impressed by that book, he told me I should try and read some of her books. And the first one I did read was Evil Under the Sun, I remember. And I absolutely loved that one. And then, you know, basically what happened is I just went to every library in Reykjavik that I could find and just picked up one Christie book after another. Not all of them have been translated and not all of them were in print. So, but I bought those that I could and borrowed those that were available. And in just the space of a couple of years, I pretty much finished everything I could get my hands on. And then I moved to the... I had to basically go to the National Library to read what was still available in Icelandic but was out of print. And I spent for quite some time, I spent every Saturday morning there with my father reading these old titles. And even the library, you know, the reading room of the library wasn't even open for anyone under the age of 16, and I was not 16 at the time, so we had to. I had to get my father to take out the books, and then I would sneak, you know, read them without being stopped. So, so it was, you know, a big adventure, and that was pretty much my introduction to Christie. But actually, I before I started reading the books, I remember I had seen some Christie movies on television, and I think the first one I saw was The Seven Dials Mystery, like an early 1980s. TV movie, and I was, you know, I really liked that one, and I think that was the first time I really heard of Agatha Christie, and I thought the twist of that movie was so and the book as well was so clever that she sort of stuck in the back of my mind, and I thought, you know, I should probably try and get to know some more of her stuff.
Mm. You said the first book you read was Evil Under the Sun. What was it about that one that kind of grabbed you, that kept you reading?
I think it's, you know, partly the atmosphere, and then, and you know, Poirot as well. I mean, I did a lot of translations, and a lot of those were Poirot books. And so I've always been, I think, you know, he was the first character I really got into, and then later on Miss Marple and also Tommy and Tuppence. Mm. But I think it's the atmosphere of Evil Under the Sun, and just, you know, this classic, it's a classic Christie with a limited cast of suspects on a, you know, in a sort of cutaway location. Mm-hmm. So that's really everything. And also it's very clever. The solution was good.
It is. It's a great solution. Almost impossible, physically impossible.
Yeah.
So you, as you just said, you've translated quite a lot of Christie's into Icelandic. What is important for you as a translator for this kind of work? Can you kind of take us through the process of what a translation, like what that process is for you?
Yes. So first of all, I mean, I'm often asked why I don't translate my own books into English. And the answer is always the same, that I think you should translate into your native language. So I think the first, step is you translate into the, you know, because you're rewriting the book really in your own language. So you have to have full control of the language you are translating into. And also, I mean, you are basically rewriting the book. I mean, you try and keep to the, you stay faithful to the story, but the Icelandic readers will be reading your, you know, your language and your phrases. And what I tried to do with my Christie translations at the time was to keep the language a little bit old, a little bit classic, so people would still be in Christie's world of the 30s or 40s. So I tried to stay away from very modern languages and very modern phrases. And I think, you know, that I think worked for Christie's book. But if you're doing like a contemporary thriller translation, it's a totally different matter.
Yeah. And so you've written a little bit about when you translated Lorge Edward Dies, that took you, what was it, 10 years? I think, and you said that there was a particular word you kind of got hung up on. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, do you want any spoilers or not?
You can give all the spoilers you want. We are a spoiler-friendly podcast. We just tell our listeners that there will be a spoiler.
Yeah. So if I'm going to go into that, I mean, I think I'll have to tell you a little bit about the solution, but not all of it. But it, I mean, the whole translation process of Lord Edward Dies didn't take me 10 years, but it took me probably 10 years to get the courage to do it, because it was always high on my list. Because it was it's an early Poirot that had not been published in book form in Iceland before. And I was trying to do as many Poirot books in my translation as possible. And not all of them have, I think, yet been done, but most of them now. But there was, because I, you know, I loved the book and I'd read it, of course, before. And there was, you know, one of the clues in the story, and here comes the spoiler, is the... Is the you know, the words he and she, where she turns to he in a way, and these two words, you know, don't sound the same in Icelandic, so it was really in a way impossible to do the clue properly in a different language. And what I spent this time on while I was sort of trying to find a way to do this book was, I looked up Scandinavian, like Norwegian, Swedish translations of this book, and I was trying to see if anyone had sort of come up with an idea to do it properly in translation. But in the end, it didn't really work out. And I still did the book, but I just had to do a footnote to explain the clue. But it's such a vital clue in the story that I really wanted to try and get it right. But you know, nevertheless, it's a fantastic story, and it was great fun to do it. But But this was, you know, this was probably the biggest challenge I had with translations. But others, I mean, I was quite young when I started doing this. I was 17 for the first book. So there were a lot of surprises on the way. I remember in the Christie books, people are always eating kidney pie.
And yeah, for an iPhone, yeah.
I had no idea what that was.
And yeah, you're better off not knowing.
Yes, I guess I am. And you know, directly translated, it sounds very sort of
traumatic.
You would not eat.
Yeah.
So that was one problem, you know, to try and get that across. I had really no idea what that was in effect. And another phrase that Christie used a lot were the French windows. And it took me a while to realize, you know, that these were actually doors, not windows, and people kept walking out of windows.
I know. It's very confusing if you don't know what those are.
Yeah, but sort of little by little, I started to grasp these concepts.
That's so interesting. Now, so you talked a little bit about how you kind of tried to take on more of the old-fashioned language to keep the books in their proper time. As a translator, do you ever come up against words or concepts that you kind of try to change a little bit because, like, they won't suit a modern reader, or do you try to stay as true to the book as you can?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since I did these books, but I think there may have been like a few instances where, you know, you would sort of try to phrase the, you know, to use you know, proper phrases in, you know, for a modern reader.
Yeah,
I think you would sort of stay away from from language that would be difficult to read nowadays. And we know, you know, there are of course some instances of that in the books, but specifically, I don't think there was anything that sort of was very problematic in the books that I did. Not that I can recall, but you try and stay true to the story, of course. But I think translators would maybe have a little bit of leeway in sort of modernizing the phrases.
Sure, and certain phrases I would imagine don't mean the same thing in an Icelandic context that they would in an English one.
Absolutely. And so I think no translator really does like a word for word translation. I mean, it's always about the context out there and making the text sound good in the new language. And so I think, yeah, I think that's really the mission of a good translation.
Yeah. You've written that translating Christie really helped you with your own crime writing. What is it about translating that gives you insight into the writing process?
So first of all, I mean, it's just the structure of a story.
Yeah.
And you have translated a book or even, you know, like I did quite a few books. It's sort of, it gives you like a, you know, almost like the courage to do a story of your own, because you've seen through the magic a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you read a novel and you just enjoy it as a reader, I mean, it is a bit magical, and it's hard to see how the author and you know, from start to finish. But in the translation process, you really have to go into every single word and suddenly the structure sort of becomes a little bit more clear than it would if you were just reading for your own enjoyment.
Yeah.
And so I think she taught me that. And you know, you learn instinctively the structure and the you see that this can be done. I mean, you can, if you can sit down and translate the whole book, I mean, theoretically, it could take you about the same time to write your own book. And so you see basically that this is possible. I mean, a whole novel is not an impossible project to finish. And also, I mean, I think she influenced the way my books, the length of my books, because I tend to write shorter books than probably most Scandinavian authors do. And I think that's the direct Christie influence, because when I started writing my first book, I just went to my translations on my computer. And I looked up, you know, how many words is a crime novel? And Agatha Christie was the benchmark, basically, because I had all these documents and I could see that, you know, there was some target length that I could reach. And for that reason, my books are sort of relatively short, more like a golden age length. And And I'm, and you know, and on top of that, of course, just by reading Christie and translating Christie, she has taught me a lot about plotting, obviously, and setting. I mean, she was fantastic at both, you know, selecting a setting that's very, very, very memorable, and the plotting. And you know, some people have said that she has taken all the best, she has used all the best twists.
Yeah.
To an extent, that is correct. I mean, she has, you know, many of the best, but yet most simple twists have been used by Christie. And the beauty of the, as my friend, I think you had him on your podcast a while ago, John Curran, once said to me that, you know, the beauty of Christie's plots is that you can usually explain them in just one short sentence. Mm-hmm. It's not complicated, just brilliant.
That's true. Yeah, it's almost an elevator pitch of a novel.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many times would you say, when you start out to do a translation, how many times do you read the book through before you dive into the actual translation? Like, how familiar with the plot and its turns do you need to be and its language before you actually dive into the element of, like, the work of translating?
So when I started, I was just a teenager, so I had no idea what the protocol for this. So I have to admit, the first book I did, I just did it as a, you know, I was reading it for the first time while I was doing the translation.
Oh, wow. That's tough. Freestyle translation. That's impressive.
It was, yeah. And I mean, that was a lot of fun for me as well. And but most of them I had, you know, when I did a few more, most of them I had read before, but not many times, you know, usually the only once before. So I think that is fine. I think you can pretty much get away with just translating from the first, you know, just reading and translating at the same time. I think some people actually do that even.
Oh, yeah. So you've done quite a lot of Christie's now, but is there a book that you are keen to tackle in the future? And are there any that you are like, I'm never going to tackle that one?
I was keen to do like Curtin, the last one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, please.
But since I stopped translating and started writing, someone else actually did that into Icelandic. So that is not something I need to do. So I don't think there is any Christie that I'm dying to do, but I would love to do a few more if I had the time. It's a lot of fun. I just did my first translation project in more than a decade this year when I was doing a translation of a play, not a Christie play, but a play for the National Theatre here in Iceland. And so to do like maybe a mystery play in translation might be nice. Mm-hmm. I mean, the book that I probably would not do is the last one, the Postern of Fate.
Mm-hmm.
That was the last Christie book I read. You know, I had read all of them before, but this one was the one that I sort of, was not too keen to read.
Yeah,
it's not her best book, obviously, and
no,
I think that there are titles that have not been translated yet that should probably come first.
Okay, and of the ones you've translated, do you have a favorite like translation? Not necessarily a favorite book, but like the one you've had the most fun translating.
Oh. I mean, I did Death on the Nile, which had not been done in Icelandic before, and I was quite proud of that because that's a brilliant book. And the first one I did was Endless Night, and it also has like a place in my heart because it was the first one I did. But it's not my favorite Christie book, but it's a very good one, a very good late Christie. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I had a lot of fun with all of them. And I did a few short stories as well. I mean, The Adventure of the Christmas Pudding was one that I really liked.
That's a really fun one. So obviously you are a crime writer as well, and you write more in kind of like the Nordic noir genre, which is kind of its own, you know, the Iceland and the Nordic region has developed this genre, and it's a lot darker, I would say, than Christie's work typically. How do you think in terms of like how Kristi is received in Iceland and maybe across Scandinavia, how do you think she fits in terms of like the types of crime books that people typically like to read?
Yeah, I think Kristi is usually quite widely read in Scandinavia. And I mean, a lot of people start with Kristi on their way, you know, from young adult books or children's books on their way to reading other types of literature or other types of crime fiction, because she's easily accessible and widely available. And so I think she's really well loved in Scandinavia and as, you know, as pretty much everywhere. And if a book is, you know, if people hear that a book has sort of Kristi elements to it, I mean, it starts to, you know what you're getting, and you know, and most people would sort of, in a way, like it. And I think she has, been a great influence on a lot of authors in one way or another. And speaking of like Scandinavian crime specifically, we had Stieg Larsson like 10 years ago or more, or whose books really broke through into the US and the UK and everywhere. And the first one in his trilogy, I think, was very much a nod to Kristi. I mean, it was very much, in parts, a book that Kristi could have written. I mean, in parts it was violent and modern, but in parts it was like an old-fashioned detective story with a limited, list of suspects, a close environment. So I think you know, her influence has created some stars in Scandinavia. But of course, some of them are writing something completely different, much sure. darker and much more realistic. But for me, I usually try to write books that I would like to read. So I think there's always a bit of Kristi in what I would do, or what I would write.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting because I think Kristi has been kind of backed into this corner of like cozy mysteries. And I understand why people call them that. And I find them to be comforting as my reading. But a lot of her books are not that cozy. And I think revisiting that title might be worthwhile because in particular books, like there's really a sense of evil that pervades that I think is not very cozy. And that can definitely be a progenitor of any type of mystery, including the Nordic noir genre.
I think you're right. I mean, I would not call Kristi's book cozy in the way that that term is used for mysteries now. I mean, I think they're definitely comforting to read. And I agree with you that if if I've had a difficult day and just want to, wind down, a Kristi book is the most comforting book you can read, because it opens up this world of this imagined world where everything is so quiet and yet so interesting. But there is a lot of darkness in these stories, and many of them. I mean, it's all about good and evil, and even though there's maybe not a lot of violence in the books, there is a lot of the motives behind the many of the crimes are very dark I mean, I think she has she gets more and more credit for that in recent years.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I think when she was considered to be very sort of dated, and then people realized that was not the case at all.
Yeah.
And we've seen in some of the modern adaptations as well that people are sort of, showing us some more of the darkness. I mean, there is a lot of depth in Kristi's books.
I agree. And I think for me, what that depth is really like the exploration of the mundanity of evil, which is that it can appear in St. Mary Mead. It can appear at your summer house. It can appear in your holiday. Like these regular places that we all are, that is where evil lurks. And I think that is kind of the most troubling or pervasive element that, takes away that cozy feeling, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And some of the murders in her books are really evil in a way. I mean, it's not accidental killings that someone's trying to cover up. It is premeditated and it is dark.
Yeah. I agree. Well, I think that's a good place to dive into the book we're going to talk about today, which is Murder on the Links. I am going to give a little historical note, and then I'm going to turn it over to you for your synopsis. So, Murder on the Links was published in the US and UK in 1923 after its initial serial publication in Grand Magazine through 1922 and 23. It is the second Poirot and Hastings book after The Mysterious Affair at Styles in 1920. The book was closely based on an actual French murder case of the time. There have been a few TV and radio adaptations, including the ITV Poirot with David Suchet and Hugh Fraser as Arthur Hastings. And I just want to say, I talk a lot on the podcast, I know, about how much I love David Suchet as Poirot, because I do, but I don't think I've spoken enough about how much I love Hugh Fraser as Arthur Hastings. He's really charming, he's sweet, he's funny, and the chemistry between Suchet and Hastings is just, and Fraser rather, is really fantastic. So as much as David Suchet kind of imbues Poirot, I think, with a humanity that sometimes doesn't appear on the page, Hugh Fraser gives Hastings a kind of sense of personhood that we don't always get from the books, because Hastings is our window. So that's that. Critical reception of the book was fairly good, with comparisons to Sherlock Holmes. It's not considered one of Christie's best works today, but which Robert Barnard chalks up to the ending, in which, quote, "ingenuity triumphs over common sense," end quote. So that's our little note on Murder on the Links. Ragnar, will you give us a 1 minute or so synopsis of Murder on the Links?
Yes. So as you said, I mean, it is the second Poirot and Hastings book. And so it's an early Christie, and it's set in the UK, but mostly in the north of France, where Poirot is, goes to investigate. And when he goes there, he... The crime he's investigating is the death of a man who is found dead in an open grave on a golf course. So that is sort of the basic concept at the start of the story, with some quite fantastic setting and a cast of characters. And also, this is quite well known by Christie fans as the book where Hastings falls in love and Agatha Christie tries to get rid of him, for the first time, at least, and thankfully this was not his final book with Poirot, but basically it's an early Poirot and Hastings, and it has a lot of the early charm of this fantastic series.
Thank you. That was a lovely synopsis. So yeah, I agree with you that I'm very glad that Hastings was not booted off to Argentina quite so quickly. So why did you choose Murder on the Links as your book?
So yes, as I mentioned before, when I was reading Christie for the first time, I had to find some of the titles in the National Library in Iceland, this old reading room in a lovely old building downtown in Reykjavik, and one of these books was The Murder on the Links, which was published in Icelandic in the 1940s, I think, and was in 1941 for the first time, and was out of print. I have very strong memories of reading this book in this old library, it's fantastic old desks with green cloths and green leather seats, and just me alone with a book, and it probably took me a few weekends to get through the whole book. It might have been that I was trying to get through it before the series was shown, but maybe not, maybe that was later, but at least this is one of the books that I very fondly remember reading from this place, and so that is one of the reasons why I love it, because often the way you remember books is partly based on where you read them. But having said that, I mean, I think it is still a fantastic story. I mean, I love Poirot and Hastings together, and there are not many books with the two of them, and especially not like an early one where we are seeing the characters being built up, and And the atmosphere is so, so classic. It's so very, very golden age. I mean, it's a 1920s story around the same time that, you know, as Ellery Queen, the cousins were doing the first Ellery Queen mysteries. S.S. Van Dyne was doing the first File of Vance mysteries. It is really, you know, I think this is really a strong decade for Golden Age, you know, the mid and early 20s.
Yeah.
So I think the setting plays a part in a way. I mean, it is an exotic setting for a British crime mystery. And of course, Hastings falling in love is a bit charming as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, because so this isn't really one of my reread books. Like I have kind of a, you know, quite a few Christie's that I reread a lot, and this isn't one of them. But I was so glad that you asked me to do this book, because rereading it, I remembered how charming I find it. And the charm is totally wrapped up in the romance between Hastings and Cinderella. And I don't typically find Christie romances to be super convincing, but I find this one to be really convincing and really lovely. What do you think about the romance?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is quite lovely, as you say, and it is a theme throughout Christie's mysteries. It's almost always like some sort of romance that is a part of the whole solution. I mean, there is usually some romantic engagement at the end of the stories that, you know,
mm-hmm.
that you saw coming or not. Sometimes it's almost like a twist. But I think we probably relate to this one more than the others because it's Hastings and it's a character we love, not just, you know, a single use character. But I think she does this, you know, very well, and I think she probably enjoyed doing the romance part of the stories.
Yeah, and I also think Cinderella is a great character because she's not kind of the typical, like overly twee adventurous girl that we find in some of the other 20s, like more like adventure novels. She's actually quite complicated, and has her full complexity given to her and allows Hastings to see her in that full complexity. And I really like that about the romance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great character.
Yeah. So for me, this book has always been quite a lot about like cementing Hastings as a character. I think his goofiness, his love of auburn-haired women, which we encounter again and again, his never fails to be wrong at, you know, guesses. What do you think makes Hastings an interesting character, despite the fact that he is kind of meant to be a bit of a dum-dum?
I like a book with a you know, a good narrator, and mm-hmm. I think he shows us Poirot in a different light, because there is this sort of, there is almost this strain between them. I mean, he loves Poirot, but he is a little bit envious of him as well, and a mm-hmm. little bit annoyed as well in a friendly way. And so I think he brings out the best in Poirot.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, obviously he is, in a way, it's based on Sherlock Holmes and Watson. And I think that is probably one of the reasons why Christie tried to move away to do something that was, you know, she may have found more original than this, you know, narrator detective relationship. But I mean, I think it was, I think she should have stuck with him for more books because it is a lovely, it's a lovely relationship that they have, and and I think he gives Poirot more depth, and you know, when they did the David Suchier and Hugh Fraser series, I mean, they obviously picked up on that, and so they used him a lot more than you would have, you know, if you only seen the series and not read the books, you'd probably think that he's on all of the
Think he's a constant. Yeah, I think that's right. And I also, as you say, he's a great counterpart to Poirot in that he humanizes him. You see a friendship and what that looks like for Poirot, who's a very loyal person. And you also, it also gives great comic relief. I mean, I think Hastings is really funny, and the way Faro talks to him is often very funny. And I would also say, I mean, you mentioned Curtin earlier, the most profound book. I love reading Curtin, and I think it's an incredible book, and it's so profound because it really closes a loop on a lifelong relationship. And Hastings and Poirot's relationship is very beautiful in that way. So I agree with you. I think they're a great pair.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and Curtin is a fantastic book. And I mean, even though I picked this one as, you know, as my favorite in a way, I mean, it doesn't really mean that it's necessarily the best book. I mean, obviously, obviously, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd is a groundbreaking detective story, and probably by all definitions, your best book. And then The Wannon as well is another one that is absolutely brilliant in construction. And Curtin, Curtin is truly one of her best books, as well as you say.
I agree. And it's interesting, a lot of people have told me that they won't read Curtin because they don't want to, you know, they don't want Poirot to die, which I think is such an interesting take because, you know, he's a character, so you can just go back in time to any book and he's there. Time is a flat circle, as they say. But I think that's like an interesting take that they wouldn't want to read it because it is such a worthy book, I think, of what happens in the book. I think it really is the greatest ending that Christie could have given him.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, I have to say I put off reading Curtin for many, many years.
You
did. It was one of the last, for that same reason. I mean, it was one of the last Christies I read for the first time. And it's not many years ago that I actually, you know, read it to the end. Mm-hmm. And that was just, you know, basically this reason. It was like this hidden treasure that you just wanted to keep and save. And also you don't want Poirot to die, obviously.
Yeah, of course. So moving on to maybe not such a nice character, I find Giraud, who is kind of the French detective, to be a really fascinating foil to Poirot in this book. Poirot doesn't typically work like in opposition to the police, except for in a couple of instances, like the ABC murders comes to mind. But what do you think Giraud is meant to show us, like show the readers about Poirot?
I mean, I think it's supposed to be, it's supposed to show us the different types of detection techniques.
Yeah.
And he is more of the, you know, traditional policeman crawling around looking for clues. The type of policeman that Poirot really can't stand.
Yeah.
Because he feels that he should just, you know, sit down and think the story, you know, think the plot through and figure it out that way and not look for clues. And so I think that in a way that is, you know, it's supposed to show us that Poirot is a different type of detective, more of the, you know, Holmes type. But I mean, it's probably also like just a reflection of, you know, different nationalities, different jurisdictions. We have this, you know, Belgian detective from England coming into France and, you know, into someone else's territory.
Yeah, I think that's true. So this is a very early Christie mystery. In what ways do you think this is kind of a good example of her work? And in what ways do you think her work diverges in later books?
I mean, I think this is a very good example of an early Christie. And for me, it's a better book than the first one. I mean, although Styles is a brilliant debut. I think people may tend to forget, you know, how accomplished it is as a debut, but I think this one is even better and probably one of the best, you know, except for Murder of Roger Ackroyd from the first decade of her work. And it's like a definitive detective story. It has, you know, it has clues, it has a detective, his you know, his narrator and his limited group of suspects in an interesting location, and it's all about the mystery and the detection, and it's a very much a golden age detective story. but I think obviously Christy, you know, developed her style and you know what she wanted to do in later years, and I mean she definitely managed to almost perfect the this format, this detective story format in the next 10 to 20 years. And then she moved into like a little bit more realistic stories, even, you know, with some thriller elements or some modern critique of, you know, of contemporary society in a way as well. So as Poirot grew older and lost Hastings, the stories became a bit different, and, you know, just depends on taste, which era you like best. But then it all came together with Curtin. But obviously that was written much earlier as well. So that brought us really back to the detective story classic that she could do.
That's right. Are you a puzzle reader? Like when you were reading them, were you trying to figure out the ending, or do you just enjoy the ride?
No, absolutely. I'm trying to figure out the ending. I mean, And that is what has, you know, that's what's drawn me to the Golden Age stories and to writing crime fiction as well. It's just, you know, the joy of the puzzle. It's almost like in some ways, it's almost like a mathematical, you know, challenge to try and, you know, see things and try and figure out where the author is trying to fool you and get there ahead of him or her. But usually, I mean, Christy usually got the better of me. I mean, I think the very, very few instances that I can remember where I got some or part of the solution before I read it. And it is, I mean, she does it brilliantly. And it's always, she always plays very fairly with the reader.
Yeah, that's true.
Which I also appreciate. I think you can read it as a completely, you know, just for the enjoyment of it. And when you reread them, I mean, obviously that's what you're doing because you may know the ending, but, you know, for the first time, I think you definitely, you know, want to compete with Poirot or Marple and, you know, try and figure it out. And when I was younger, I used to write down the names of the characters and, you know, just keep a list and try and get into this properly.
You were part of the detective club. That's so cute.
In a way. Yeah.
I just liked the ride. And I have a kind of shocking almost ability to forget who did it in my rereadings. I'm like managed to still be surprised 20 years into reading these books sometimes, which doesn't speak well to my memory. But yes, I mean, most of them I know by now, but every once in a while I start reading one and I go, oh my God, I actually cannot remember how this ends. Because the setup is always so good, you know, it lays things out and you kind of start, your mind starts going in a million different directions.
Yeah, I know. And that's, I mean, there are, you know, every now and then I find an old Christie book that I reread because I honestly can't remember exactly the ending. But these are few and far between, and usually these are not the best books because the iconic stories are so, you know, the plots are so brilliant that you really can't forget them.
I think that's true. Yeah, it tends to be the more obscure ones that I can't remember always. That's true. I do remember my point now that I was going to make about Giro, which is that I think he also provides a really interesting contrast to Poirot's ego, which is always so on display. I mean, Poirot is an egotistical character. But Giraud's whole thing is throughout the process, he wants to be seen as brilliant every step of the way, whereas Poirot doesn't care if anyone thinks he's an idiot throughout the entire case, as long as by the end he has the answer and blows them all away. He kind of likes pulling that on people. So I think that was also like an interesting contrast of egos, like how ego can actually affect your work if you can kind of save it to the end.
I think that's true. Yeah.
That was my great point that I finally pulled out of the air. Anyway, well, so I think this is a great place to end. And you have written so many books yourself, not just translations, obviously, your own books. Where can people, would you like to be found by the people, and where can they find you, if so?
Oh, where can they find me? everywhere on social media. They can find me on Instagram. I think Instagram. That's the best place.
Yeah. Okay. And so, you have a website as well.
Yes. So, the website is just myname.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll have that in the episode notes. Very complicated. And the social media. And is there, if there's a book like that you recommend people start with of your books, what would it be?
So I think I'll go for a couple. One of them is The Darkness, which is the one that's being done for television. So that should be out next year in English as a series.
So
if you want to head start, you could read that one. The other one is called Snowblind, and that's probably one of the most Christie-esque mysteries I've done. And that's set in like this small town in Northern Iceland by a snowstorm. So yeah. So it's very Christie.
It's really great. I recommend everyone read it. But we'll have all of those links in the episode notes. And thank you so much for chatting with me tonight. This was really fun, and I hope you had a good time.
Yeah, I mean, speaking about Agatha Christie is always such a pleasure for me. So, I mean,
me too. That's why I do this podcast. Amazing. Well, thank you again, and I hope you have a great night.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Thanks, Agnes. Bye.
This podcast is produced by Kate Crichel with sound engineering by Winter Robinson. Our next episode features At Bertram's Hotel. Hooray! This will be our last episode of season 2, so thanks for listening and reading along. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.